Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by Jacqueline Wilson, who's working towards her Master of Arts in Cultural Apologetics from Houston Christian University. And Jacqueline will be sharing some of the context for a paper that she recently presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. I'm actually rocking the George Fox University jumper here, which I don't know whether you can see that, but that's what it is. And the title for Jacqueline's paper was A Very Ordinary Layman, C.S. Lewis's Prayer Life in Historical Context. Well, Jacqueline, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. The pleasure is mine.
Oh, this is absolutely delightful to be talking to you. But what I wondered, before we talk specifically about your paper, I wondered whether you would share something of your studies. Because obviously, you know, we love apologetics here on the C.S. Lewis podcast and on our sister programs as well. So why did you decide to focus on cultural apologetics?
That's actually a very good question. I didn't know that I was interested in cultural apologetics. It kind of just came up on me in my undergrad degree. I guess it was a very anti-Christian school, and I took an ancient literature class, and we were studying the Bible, and it was a very anti-Christian perspective of the Bible. And so I wrote my paper, and I was trying to put in the Christian perspective, and I got an okay grade, but I got this long essay from my teacher afterwards, and my classes just kind of kept continuing like that, where I'd try to put in a Christian perspective to their anti-Christian view, and it was very uncomfortable. But then COVID hit, and I needed something to do during my spare time, so I signed up for Word on Fire Institute, and Dr. Holly Ordway has an imaginative apologetics course on there, and I didn't know what apologetics was, but I liked the picture in the advertisement, so I clicked on it, and I was like, oh, that's what I was trying to do. So I hadn't ever heard of Dr. Ordway, but I really, really liked that class, and it was exactly what I was trying to do in my undergrad with my papers. So I looked her up on social media and found out that she was teaching a Tolkien's Modern Reading class at Houston Christian University. And so I audited that and started talking to the students who were in that class with me and found out about the program and said, why not? I'll give it a shot. So
brilliant. But how has your work, or has your work, led you to looking at C.S. Lewis specifically in the context of apologetics?
Yeah, so at Houston Christian University, there's an imaginative apologetics course with Dr. Michael Ward. And before I took that class, I was familiar with Lewis, but I didn't really know much about him. But as I was rereading the Chronicles of Narnia as an adult, I just thought, wow, this man has such a deep relationship with God, the way he portrays Aslan. And then we read also The Four Loves, Until We Have Faces. And I was just really, really intrigued by how he talks about love and what love is, and how when it's well-ordered, everything in life just kind of goes the way it's supposed to. And I wanted to learn more about that. And I was like, oh, he has to have a really great prayer life to have such an understanding of love and God. And I want that. So that kind of made me want to study Lewis more and his prayer life.
And do you think there is anything, or what do you think we can learn from Lewis about cultural apologetics? Because people hail him as, obviously he was an English scholar, not a theologian, but he has right. become a brilliant apologist in so many people's eyes. But what do you think we can learn about him, about the way he does apologetics? I guess, particularly in your context, in the more cultural apologetics.
Yeah, I think what makes him so great is he illustrates everything he says. So he has a statement and then he gives you an illustration of it that kind of ignites your imagination so you experience what he's saying. And that's what happened with me when I read The Great Divorce. You know, I'd always heard of, you know, love is free and love lets you go. And I didn't really understand what that meant until I read The Great Divorce. And there's this beautiful illustration of this mother who wants to hang on to her child and actually bring him into hell with her. And but there's this good spirit that's saying, no, 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 don't do that. And with that illustration, I don't know, it ignites the imagination so that you can experience what he's saying. And so you get the ration and the reason, but then you also, it hits you emotionally. So it becomes more real. And so I feel like for at least me, you know, you could tell me a fact over and over and over again until you're blue in the face. But for some things, I have to experience it to really come to believe it and understand it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. And I think that's why so much of his imaginative work, the fiction, you wouldn't necessarily think of his fiction as apologetics, but actually yeah. it is so powerful in the way that it's almost sort of apologetics by stealth, isn't it?
He
sneaks it in without you even realizing.
Yeah.
And if we just rewind right back to the beginning of your journey with C.S. Lewis, when did you first encounter C.S. Lewis, Jacqueline?
Yeah, my dad read me and my sister The Chronicles of Narnia before bed. They were our bedtime stories. So I guess I kind of got the gospel message there through The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And I remember I really enjoyed The Chronicles of Narnia.
And do you feel like there are any ways that he's particularly impacted your life, your faith journey, your works?
Yeah, definitely. I think his perspective on love really, really hit home for me. I remember in my early 20s, I began to become more serious about my faith. And if anyone didn't believe it, believe in God, it would just hurt my heart so much. And it was probably very, very annoying trying to continuously preach the gospel message to them when they weren't ready for it, or they just didn't want to hear it. And that's when I read The Great Divorce and I thought, oh, you know, because at some point, the I don't know how many people in your audience are familiar with the story, but there's these spirits who are kind of like in this hell slash purgatory journey, and these good spirits from heaven come and they try to help them see the error of their ways and to become better people. And at some point, the good spirits have to say, okay, I've done my job and it's time for me to go back and you've made your choice. And I wasn't doing that for people. I was just harping and harping and harping the point. But to see that so beautifully illustrated, and I thought actually that I was a bad person if I let it go. But to see that like in my imagination and to kind of even experience it, there was no way in the world I could think the good spirits in The Great Divorce were bad for letting these people go. And I was like, that was an aha moment for me. Like, oh, I've done my job. I can let go. They've made their choice. Maybe they're not ready for it. We can come back to it later if necessary. You know, like, stop.
But I suppose the way he told you that was through story, which is much more powerful than him like giving you a strong argument, which maybe would have just, you know, you would have.
Yeah, I needed to see it. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, let's talk about your paper for the conference. Why did you decide to explore this particular area of Lewis's work?
I guess I wanted to grow in my relationship with God. And I felt after reading Lewis, especially in Dr. Ward's class and rereading The Chronicles of Narnia as an adult, that he must have had a really strong prayer life because prayer is what brings us into relationship with God. And so I wanted to know, well, what did he do? And of course, as I started studying it, and I was like, oh, he says he's an ordinary Anglican, but he also has like these very, I'm Roman Catholic. So I could recognize, oh, he's got some Roman Catholic practices. And that was kind of a tangent, I guess, in wanting to know how he prayed. But it was interesting to me. Yeah.
And where does that phrase, a very ordinary layman, come from that you used in your title?
Yeah, so it comes from the preface of Mere Christianity. He's just kind of making a disclaimer that he's a very ordinary Anglican or layman of the Church of England, and just kind of just spelling out, this is what I believe, but I'm only going to talk about what's common to most Christians.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Before we get back to the show, I want to tell you about a brand new resource that we're offering this month from N.T. Wright. Ask N.T. Wright Anything, The Essential Collection. It's a compilation of Tom's most asked questions, like, should we pray to God the Father or Jesus? Should Christians improve the world if it's all being renewed anyway? Or how can I be a Christian and make sense of modern questions that defy God's existence? This resource is our thank you gift when you support Premier Insight this month. Your generosity equips believers across the country with biblical wisdom in a confused world. Go now to premierinsight.org/donate to request your copy. That's premierinsight.org/donate. Now, let's get back to today's show.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now, let's return to the conversation. Now, Jacqueline, you say in your paper that Lewis developed several prayer practices that were unusual for an Anglican. Mm-hmm. We're obviously going to hear your paper and hear you unpack some of those. But just as a little top line, what were some of those practices that you spotted, as you say, as a Roman Catholic, thinking, oh, that sounds a bit unusual for an Anglican? What were some of those unusual prayer practices?
Yeah, so the most unusual one, I think, was praying for the dead, because the 39 articles of religion that are adopted by the Church of England say that purgatory, or the belief in purgatory, is repugnant to the word of God. And I thought, whoa, okay, that's unusual. The way he, I think it's kind of comical the way that Lewis gets around that, and he says, oh, well, it's only the Romish doctrines of purgatory is repugnant. So if I can believe in purgatory, just not what the Catholic Church believes. So yeah, that was really interesting. And then Anglicans do have communion and confession, but the way he practiced them was more like an Anglo-Catholic or a Roman Catholic would, because he frequented them more than what would have been normal.
And you say that he apparently took up more regular confession after writing the Screwtape Letters.
Yes.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, yes. And I don't know why he did that. I think George Sayer thought it was because he thought it was bad for him to be imagining himself as a devil tempting people. So maybe he just became more aware of sin and temptation and wanted to kind of purify himself from that. Mm. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just, I thought that was really interesting when I heard you say that. Now, how would Lewis have perceived Catholics and Catholic practices? Obviously, as you say, he practices some Catholic practices, but he did have some Catholic friends, didn't he?
Yeah, I think he really, really respected them. I know he was very good friends with J.R.R. Tolkien, and Tolkien actually played a huge role in his conversion to Christianity. And Hugo Dyson, too, he wasn't Catholic, but he was Anglo-Catholic. So, of course, he had a lot of Roman Catholic practices, I suspect. So I think he had a great respect and admiration for them. He obviously disagreed on some points of their beliefs and practices, but overall, I think he really respected them.
Yeah, and I guess particularly having grown up in Northern Ireland, where there was perhaps more of an anti-Catholic stance within particular circles than there might, you know, in some ways he grew up with a bias against Catholics. So it's interesting that
right.
actually he had Catholic friends and adopted some Catholic practices, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's actually really impressive how far he overcame those biases. I mean, he grew up, I mean, people would say that Catholics were from the devil. You know, that's pretty strong. And being a little boy and just susceptible to, you know, the beliefs of those around him, I think it would probably have been really hard to overcome those biases. I do wonder if maybe, you know, his mom hired two Catholic servants. So maybe that played a role in his ability to overcome. I don't know. But it's really interesting. And I really admire him for being able to overcome those biases.
Yeah, well, you mentioned in your paper that his grandfather, Thomas Hamilton, was known for his, and I quote, extraordinary violent attacks on Roman Catholics, whom he regarded as literally possessed by the devil.
Yeah.
That is strong wording, and from your grandfather as well, to overcome that sense of bias and to be able to say some of the things that he says. That's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And now, in order to see where C.S. Lewis is coming from when we're thinking about these spiritual practices, do you think it's helpful to understand something of Anglicanism generally so that we can see sort of whether he was or wasn't an ordinary Anglican?
Yeah, of course. I think, you know, there's such a broad range of beliefs in Anglicanism. I don't know, you know, I think, I'm not really sure what I think, but I think there's a lot of leeway. And so, you know, maybe he wasn't super ordinary, like right in the middle, like he claims to be in the preface of Mere Christianity. I would have probably put him more as Anglo-Catholic, even though he didn't want to be called that.
Like, is there any sense that he might have shifted throughout his life? But like, perhaps he got more Anglo-Catholic as he got older, or do we just...
Yeah. Probably.
Just going back to some of your sort of your general understanding of C.S. Lewis, do you have a favorite quotation or a book or a work of C.S. Lewis, or is it really difficult to pin down?
It's so difficult to pin down because I think it really just depends on what's happening in my life and what my needs are. I do always go back to The Great Divorce. I think that's one of my favorites. Because that was such an aha moment for me. Changed my life, changed my relationships. I was probably a really annoying person before I read that book. But I don't know. I think probably right now, just because of what's going on in my life, I probably really like this certain quote from, I actually have it here, from A Grief Observed. He says, I have gradually been coming to feel that the door is no longer shut and bolted. Was it my own frantic need that slammed it in my face? The time when there is nothing at all in your soul except a cry for help may be just the time when God can't give it. You are like the drowning man who can't be helped because he clutches and grabs. Perhaps your own reiterated cries deafen you to the voice you hoped to hear. But on the other hand, knock and it shall be opened. But does the knocking mean hammering and kicking the door like a maniac? And I just love that because I feel like in my own life, it gives me this image of knocking on the door and wanting God to answer and help you, but you're knocking so hard you forget to pause and let him open the door. So when he tries to open the door, it just slams right back in his face. And it reminds me, like, calm down. Give him a minute, Jacqueline. Like, he'll come, but you have to calm down. You can't keep slamming the door back in his face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's so much good stuff in A Grief Observed, isn't there? And it's so honest compared to a lot of his other work.
Yes.
Now, I'm aware we're here like 61 years after his death talking about various aspects. I mean, clearly you would say that he is still relevant today, even so long after his death. But do you have any idea why he's so relevant? Like, why is it that we're still talking about him and we're not talking about other writers of his age?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. First, I think he was just such a great communicator. You never doubt or to understand what he's saying. And I think it's because he always takes time to define what he means by certain things, what he means by God, what he means by love. He really takes his time in describing and defining what it is he's talking about. And then I also think that he has such a way with words where he doesn't just give you like the reasonable explanation for what he's talking about. He gives you a way to ignite your imagination so you experience it emotionally. I mean, he just kind of, I guess, evangelizes to the whole person, to your reason and your emotion, and it really strikes home. And then his subject matters are just universal concerns that I think all humans have. Like, what is love? Why would God allow pain? Just common, normal questions that everyone has. And he answers them so articulately.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.